If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
It isn't just about the grapes. It isn't just about the land. If you don't have good people that you're working with, you don't have any of that.
We're better now today with more friendly competition. The wine community bands together when anything happens in our universe, agriculturally, fires, whatever. We're there for each other. And I feel the farming community needs each other, and we need to compete with each other in a positive fashion. I think that's been good for building up Napa Valley.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 522. This week we feature Laura Diaz Munoz, winemaker and general manager at Eller's Estate in Napa Valley. North of the town of St. Helena in Napa Valley, a right turn down Eller's Lane reveals the beautiful 1886 stone tasting room of Eller's Estate. Laura Diaz Munoz, winemaker and general manager, has implemented a program of replanting and updating with her eye firmly set on the future of the estate. If the incredible stone tasting room could talk, the stories it could tell would be mind-blowing. I suggest you go visit and then listen. You can also hear Laura on our Vino Lingo segment defining the term wineria. I'm back at Eller's Estate, and I'm here with Laura Diaz Munoz. And Laura is the winemaker here at Eller's. How are you today?
I'm very good. Feeling very cold.
Yeah.
Because it has been one of the coldest nights that we had in a while here, so.
Yeah, and I should point out that I'm here in Napa. This is December 2nd or 1st?
Second.
Mm-hmm. And it feels like December, a little more so than it normally would be here, because normally it could be pretty warm, but not now.
Yeah, no, we got 28 degrees Fahrenheit last night.
You
so
have
it
had,
was cold.
You have had a contrast between, did you get up to the 117 here in summertime?
Yes, we did. We did have that heat wave. Yeah, that was bad. It was painful.
Only a few months later, here we are now. We're shivering. Not something you expect here, but good to see you again. Thanks for taking the time.
Thank you. No, thank you.
Oh, it's
good to see you again.
Thank you very much. One of the things I love about Eller's is this structure. As our viewers can see, the wall behind you, this brick, this is an old building. And it goes back to the year?
1886. This was the original winery that Bernard Eller's and his wife, Anna Eller's, built in 1886. And these stones, I will say that most of them, because there are like a mix of different colors and kinds of stones in the building, they come from the surrounding vineyards and up in the mountain, I think from Howell, they got some of those stones. And our vineyards, we own 40 acres surrounding this estate. You can find a lot of those rocks there. Yeah, it's very rocky. It's actually very rocky for being body floor.
This is a classic example, though. If the walls could talk, man.
Oh, I would love to hear those stories.
Could you imagine?
Because there's been, you know, different generations and winemakers making wine here. It hasn't been very straight, the history from Bernard Eller's to us right now. It's been, I think this building for a while was a custom craft facility too, and there were like different winemakers making wine. During Buchler years, prohibition, there were some winemakers making some wine here that they probably shouldn't be making. And I mean, those are the stories that I heard. So it's really cool to hear what they have to say.
Now, this is going to sound really silly, but have you spent any time here in the evening, at night, late at night when nobody's around?
I mean, oh, yes, I have. And I haven't felt anything, which is, you know, we have a residence and a guest house where people say that there's a story there that is might be a little bit ghosty, you will say it. And but I never felt anything, no, I guess.
I don't think you needed to tell me that, Laura. And just as another aside, AXR across the street, mm-hmm. I know that house is reputedly quite haunted.
That's what I heard too.
Yeah,
I mean, I come from Europe. I'm originally from Spain, and I grew up in a very Catholic family. We used to sit at the table winter nights, and my grandparents used to tell us stories that were very scary, and we believe in those things, and I grew up that way, especially with old buildings and surrounding us, and you know, maybe I'm just used to it. I actually love that this place has that much history.
I agree, and I think acceptance makes that easier to deal with. That's just my thinking. I don't know. But going back to the fact that you're from Spain and you had said you're from Madrid, how long have you lived in the United States?
So I came to Napa in 2007. So it's been a while, 14, 15 years now. That's all that time. I came as an intern and I got the opportunity to stay, and I just fell in love with Napa. I mean, it's an amazing place for winemakers. It's a playground to make, you know, honestly, to make wines, and the diversity that we can find in the valley is amazing. So I decided, I'll stay for 1 year, 2 years, maybe three, and now it's been 15. So, but it's been a good ride.
It's got its hooks in you. That's how that worked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Before you came here in Madrid, was it in your head that, were you interested in agriculture? Did you want to get into winemaking? I mean, how did that work for you?
Yeah, I mean, I was interested in wine very early on. And I think, you know, this coming from my father being interested in wine and selling wines with me. And I always was interested in food and anything that it was food related. And, you know, wine was always accompanying the food. This very early, I knew that I wanted to know more about wine, and I actually enrolled in tasting classes when I was 18, which, you know, legally you can drink wine in Europe. And all my background educational-wise is in science, biology, microbiology. Later on in the university, I have an opportunity to have an internship in a winery. I didn't know anything about, I mean, I knew about the winemaking process, basically most of the microbiology part of it. I just love, when I was in a winery, just the smells, tasting the wines. I worked with a consultant winemaker who was very communicative and, you know, shared with me a lot of his knowledge in a very short period of time. I just wanted to know and get to know more. So that's why I went back to the university and enroll in a Master of Winemaking and Viticulture. After that, you know, I just knew that I just wanted to work with wine. Back then, I didn't know that I was going to become a winemaker, but things took me to this direction, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, it calls you, yeah?
Yes.
And if you don't answer, well, that's dumb.
I mean, everybody that starts working with wine, I will say that 90%, they just fall in love with it. Working in the cellar, working in a winery, in the vineyards, is very hard. It's very physically demanding. And not everybody is able to just support, you know, like to go through the early hours, working when it's really cold and really hot under those conditions. But even if you have a lot of passion about something, it's something that not everybody could probably do it. But I love it. I'm actually the opposite. I'm the happiest when I'm in the cellar or in the vineyards. And I don't care if it's cold or raining or it's just, that's my place.
I think it's also this idea of this growth. And then the opposite side, this time of year, everybody's going to sleep around you. It's weird to think they're going to come back in spring. We certainly hope so.
Mm-hmm. It is amazing to see the transformation and also how the hard work that you put into something, especially with plants and vines, like how you can like transform it into something that is as good as the wine. And I don't know, to me it is magic.
I've met a lot of winemakers who had this science background to begin with. And it's not uncommon, although winemakers come from just about everywhere you can possibly imagine. But it's that science thing, I think, is the common thread that goes between all of you people. It's that curiosity, and it's that also the idea of being outdoors all the time. It's a big deal.
Yes. Making wine is science, and you cannot deny that. My main degree was in food and science technology. So it's all the process of transformation from basic ingredients to food or wine. There's a lot behind it in the science, but so you cannot avoid it. And I think, you know, winemakers, there's a lot of talking about natural wines and, you know, low intervention. At the end of the day, you need to know what you're doing. You need to understand the process. You need to understand what is actually happening from a microbiological point of view in the wine, about how the content of, you know, the components of from the juice to the wine and what is happening and all the transformations. Natural wines, they can be natural and you have to do the minimum, but you need to understand what is happening at all times. And that requires to be there. And if it's farming in the vineyards or if it's in the cellar, you need to be tasting the wines regularly. You need to understand what is happening with fermentations, how the ratio of or the rate of how the change is happening. Same with farming. And, you know, same with climate change now. We need to understand what is happening surrounding us because it's changing very quickly. Or it has changed and we didn't pay attention. It's like we constantly have to be there. We have to be in the vineyards. You have to walk the vineyards. And same in the cellar.
Yeah, listen to the vineyards.
Listen to the vineyards.
Well, I mean, there is that fact. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You talk about natural wines, and I get this. Many winemakers have talked about all wines are natural. Mm-hmm. I mean, is that just something that kind of bugs you when you hear people talk about that?
Not really. I mean, yes, I think all wines are natural. I don't like the way that in general society, not just in winemaking, we classify a wine. It's very hard for wines because some years it's easy to be low interventionist. Mm-hmm. And because things are coming along well. But other years are not as simple, and we obviously, as winemakers, we need to intervene and correct if things are not going in the direction that we want. So I don't get nervous when people talk about being natural because I understand their goals, and their goals is to be less interventionist or, you know, do less and try to maybe work behind the scenes, not in the cellar, just doing it in the farming, which is also important to understand how to be low interventionist in the farming, which, you know, that can help in different ways. But
I think if I were to give an example, I wonder if you would agree with it, is 2011 was what a lot of people will call a winemaker's vintage, mm-hmm. where there was intervention because you had such difficult growing conditions that year.
Yeah, they were difficult, but we also have to understand, they were difficult in Napa. I mean, we need to think about where was it
sure.
difficult, because, you know, it was a difficult year. It was an unexpected year because it's not common to have those rains. It's not common to have, like, cooler temperatures. But there are other wine regions that they're used to that, and they deal with it. And it is like, what is natural and what is unnatural? Did I have to intervene? Yes, but there's different tools that we can do that are considered natural, and that could have prevented some of the issues that we have that vintage. So it's just about paying attention. And right now, I think winemakers, we cannot think that every year is going to be the same. We need to be ready for constant changes. Maybe this harvest we have heat waves. Maybe next one we're going to have a rainy season. It is how climate change is making it so difficult to predict.
Yeah.
And that is what is having us very nervous. Like every vintage is so unexpected lately. That's why I think knowledge, and then that's why I think science is also important, and winemakers, we need to not to feel comfortable and things like, oh, every year I've been doing the same and it has worked perfectly, this is my style. Well, maybe we need to be open to make different style of wines.
Sure.
Because now we have to, and there's nothing wrong with it. And maybe we need to educate consumers that there's nothing wrong with it, that every vintage might taste a little bit different, but it's because the differentiation of a vintage. So that's how I see it.
Yeah. No, and that's, to me, very much a realistic point of view. If you're not a realist in this business, mm-hmm. fighting upstream. Now, how many years have you been winemaker here at Eller's Estate?
At Ehlers, I joined in 2018, so it's been four years and a half.
Mm-hmm. And you're making a lot of changes. There's been a lot of replanting. You kind of got this very strong program coming in. Tell me a little bit about that, what you've done.
I mean, Ehlers is a great place. We're talking about the historical aspect of this site. When I came, I loved the vineyards, I loved the soils, and they were farmed organically, and they've been certified organic since 2008, which is quite a bit. So it was 10 years prior to me coming here, and I really like the ecosystem that it was created here. So I didn't see any issues with the farming, but I experienced right away, even 2018 was a cool vintage. It was actually a really easy vintage compared with what we have experienced. And I had the time to observe. I had the time to, even if I started in July, it was a late harvest, so I had the time to work and try to understand the site. Obviously, it takes years to understand a site. But I realized that there was few configurations in the vineyard that were not right for what we were experiencing. And that was, you know, the heat and the raw orientations were not right in the sense that we had a huge differentiation between morning and afternoon. The afternoon was very early on, after variation, there was getting burned in some blocks, not all the blocks. And I was like, I'm losing color, I'm losing aromas, I'm losing flavors, and because of the configuration of the canopy on those vines, I was not able to control that. And also, you know, during these years, we have amazing Cabernet Franc coming from here. I think just because our soils are very gravelly, we have between 35 to 60% gravel in some of our blocks. Mm. It's amazing it's very good for Cabernet Sauvignon and Cabernet Franc. And I thought, it's like, we need to plant more Cabernet Franc. I need more Cabernet Franc, which I think is a problem that many winemakers in Napa has, because Cabernet Franc is very trendy now, and we like it, and consumers are actually liking it a lot. So I thought, you know, it took a while to rethink. It's like, what is the direction that this site needs to go? And I did all this changing, and I proposed to the owners, like, you know, we need to do this, just because I think the site will benefit in the next 20 to 25 years. I don't know where I'm going to be in the next years. You never know in right now, but it's like, I think it will be very beneficial for this site, just to change it, just to make it better for the future and to make it more resilient, basically, because I think it was struggling. We were having very low yields, extremely low yields, between less than 2 tons per acre. So it's like, you know, that economically is not also very good, very good quality, but it's just, so I thought we just put together this plan of replanting. So that's what we've been doing it. Of the 40 acres, we just replanted 20. So it's a big change. Yeah. It's a big change. It's a huge commitment. But I think it's for the best. Mm-hmm. Hopefully.
Hopefully.
I mean, I'm sure. I'm sure. Like, I'm actually very confident of the changes, because there's been a lot of data analysis and reports that we have gathered to take these decisions. And I, you know, I started working with Mike Wolf in the Valley. He's very well known, and he has lots of experience in farming, so he's been a great help.
That's great. Well, mm-hmm. You always really rely on the people around you for that advice, and I think what's unique about winemakers, I've said this 1,000 times, you live in 3 different places at the same time. You live in the past, looking at the history of the property, which you've grown. Mm-hmm. You're right now in the present of what are you doing today? What is your plan, you know, when you get up in the morning? And then now you're talking about the future, and that's really stepping out onto the ice a little bit, but yet it comes with the experience you have as a winemaker of knowing that ice is going to be solid and you're going to be able to move forward doing the right thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I just feel that we normally try to find immediate reward. We want to make wines, really good wines, right away. And sometimes I think we need just to step back and realize, it's like, this is the tools and ingredients that I have to work with. how to make them sustainable. And there's a lot of talking about sustainability in the vineyard, sustainability, economical sustainability. So it's like that I want to make this place successful, and it's been around for 135 years. Hopefully it will be around for other 100 more, you know? So
it's funny, before we were talking about ghosts, and you've got a lot of people looking over your shoulder right now, don't you?
A lot of people.
Well, from the past. I mean.
Oh, yes.
You know.
Yes, but it's like those, I mean, I cannot compare at all. We are all just doing what we think we have to do. But all those pioneers that they decide is like, you know, it's a leap of faith. Like, you actually think that something is going to work, and you really believe that it's going to work in that side. It's like, you just have to do it and put that hard work, and eventually I think it will pay off. Mm-hmm.
I've never met a winemaker yet that has been afraid of work, because that's what the gig is. And again, there's so
many. And it's pretty fun. It has actually been very fun to try to, you know, take those decisions and gather a lot of data and reading a lot and talking to other people in the Valley, winemakers and vineyard managers in the Valley that are making those changes, because it's happening in Napa.
Well, that's part of the whole collaboration thing, too. You know, you're looking at other people, maybe comparing notes, talking about subtleties, because in the end, you're all doing the same thing.
Yes.
and you want Napa Valley, just like any other part of the country, to move forward and not be in a negative position.
Mm-hmm.
Replanting, to me, again, my poor listener is probably just like, oh, would he get off the replanting thing? But it's such a fascinating concept, because number one, I would think as a winemaker, it's very exciting to watch your babies go underground, to start this process and watch where it goes from there.
It is always very rewarding, and I think that's why we like what we do. And that it can be with replanting or with anything. Like, when you experiment, which is sometimes not experimenting, it's like changing just the canopy or changing something on your farming practices that you think is going to improve. With vines, it might take 2 or 3 years to actually see the translation of that change or that, and I mean, I could tell you, like, we did different pruning, and it took a couple of years to see actually that the vines responded very well to it. We did a different kind of ripping, cutting the roots closer to the surface in some of the vines, and you can see it's like, oh, it's the struggle divine. And then after 2 years, it bloomed. It was, you know, giving us better production, and the canopy was even bigger. So it's like, you know, those different changes in the farming, they are always transforming to something that normally is better. And that's we're going back to requiring that. We need to walk the vineyards, we need to understand what is happening and act right away, not to wait and see if things will be corrected by themselves, you know?
Yeah, you really do need to be proactive. Obviously, you're meeting with people who come for specific tastings, they know who you are, they're here to see you, whatever it might be, but are you ever around the tasting room incognito? Just to try and see what people say without going, oh, you're the winemaker, oh, you know?
Well, you know, winemakers sometimes, you know, we can look very nice when we are like all clean up and and wearing nice, and then sometimes, especially during harvest, I look like a cellar worker, honestly. Like, it's especially I'm a Latina. I mean I'm from Spain, but people think that I'm, you know, I'm Latina.
Sure.
Or Mexican, or so sometimes I just go into the tasting room and they don't recognize me. And they don't know that I'm the winemaker, and I can hear them saying or talking about the wines. It has happened to me also in events or in restaurants, and I can hear, you know, when they're putting my wine in another table, and I can hear them. I have to say that normally it's positive. I mean, I think I have like a couple situations that people don't like white wines, or they don't like red wines, or but in general it's positive, but it's very fun to hear what they have to say, and they don't recognize you, or they come to me and they like a wine and they just start talking about it, and they don't know that I'm the winemaker.
Sure. That's cool. I find that, because
it has happened.
Well, you got a lot of truth that, yes, comes from that. For you as a winemaker, do you have a hero, a mentor, someone that was that made that impression on you?
I mean, I don't think that I have mentors. I work with people that has helped me a lot and supported me, But, you know, I work with people that were like, if I teach you too much, you're going to know more than me. And they were like, I was like, really? Like, you know, like I got those answers sometimes. And it's like, okay. But I had people that inspire me. I think I had people that I look at them and it's like, oh, I just want to be like them. Or, you know, they seem so professional and so knowledgeable and you know, they always put, like, really put together. So I had those moments many times with different people in the wine industry. And I, you know, very early on, and I think that what pushed me to move to travel and to just get out of Spain, because when I was working there very early on, you know, I noticed, you know, it was hard in my position to maybe become a winemaker. I was working in a lab for a big company, a big winery, and there was a consultant, she was a master of wine, and she was a woman. And I just look at her, it's like, you know, she's so knowledgeable, so good, and, you know, everybody was respecting her opinion. So, you know, that inspired me too, it's like, and to be brave enough to be like, well, now I can be closer to that or something like that.
Yeah.
So that would, you know, push me to like take risk and maybe just leave that job and go and pursue something else. And so I think it's more about having people that inspire me than mentors themselves. I found people that also like to help others. And this industry is a community. Everybody knows each other. And there's a good sense of helping each other. Early on, I worked with this consultant winemaker in Spain, Pepe Gracia, and you know he saw the spark in me. Like he saw that I had passion about it, and he helped me to find the way, or he gave me good advice. When I came here, I worked with Chris Carpenter for many years, a decade, and you know he gave me very good advices that I'm taking with me. You know, like right now, I'm very solo, I will say, here at Ehlers, because I'm, you know, managing, I'm the general manager and winemaker, and I'm managing too much on my own. And maybe I'm not working with a lot of employees. But, you know, I go to other leaders that I see in the industry, and I just ask them, I'm very honest, like, oh, I will need advice in relationship with this. And I've been very surprised how people are so passionate about this, that they are willing to share their knowledge and their experience. You know, like recently with Nicole Carter, she's the president for Rother Estate, and Mary Edwards, she manages amazing companies, and just ask her advice, business-related advice, and she was so willing to give it to me. So it's just like finding these kind of people that are where they are because of a reason, because they're really good at what they do. But there's also generosity, I will say, in the wine industry about sharing knowledge.
And likely somebody did that for them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah, yeah. I'm sure. I'm sure that they got the same.
Often I refer to winemakers as mad scientists because you can experiment. You have this background in science and you have the art of being a winemaker. Do you get that chance to play around with certain grapes that you've never done, or just do ideas that might seem a little bit odd, off color, weird, strange, whatever they might be?
I will say for the past 4 years while I was here, I mean, there's been a lot of trying, a lot of trying to understand how to improve quality and how to not make things differently, but paying more attention. Unfortunately, not with other grapes. I would love to. I would love to. In the past, you know, I worked with Riesling here in the Valley, or working from different sites. It's as much as I can, you know, experiment, I will say, but not like huge, big experiments. Yeah. I mean, I think it's more like regular winemaking trials, or, you know, like it's more about organic practices, for example, in the vineyard that we have trying to implement, or trials that are more related to how to manage heat, for example. Like in the vineyards, I've been using misters, I've been using different kind of nets to protect from the sun, different colors. So those are more like trials that, to me, is something that I've been using for many, many years. And getting a good knowledge a scientific knowledge about anything, it requires multiple years. So yeah, I've been doing, I think, I don't consider those ones like an unusual way of working. I think many winemakers right now, we are doing a lot of trials on a regular basis, basically. But sure. I would love to work with different grapes. And there's a lot of talking in Napa about, you know, replanting and maybe considering different grapes. Unfortunately, we only have 40 acres.
Sure.
So I cannot play as much as I would like to. Just looking at it as from the business point of view, obviously, which it might change. It might change in Napa if some brave vineyard managers start planting something that is different and maybe gets popular and might change the style of the wines, but that probably is going to take decades to get there. But I think that's a possibility that can happen in Napa.
Sure. Oh, and in the end, it's a business though, where you need to make a profit to be able to feed the machine.
Yes.
Can't be foolish about what you
do. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So I have that responsibility, and so I'm very careful about it. I only planted, in the replanting, I included a little bit of Malbec.
Nice.
That was about it, and a little bit of Semillon. But those are, I mean, I think specifically Malbec can be very, very heat tolerant, and it can adapt very well to this site.
Sure. And Malbec is still very popular.
It is.
Yeah, it's amazing how that came about. It is. Mm-hmm. It's a wonderful wine. It's a fun one to discover. And as a quick aside, which I meant to say before, Chris Carpenter is just a great guy. I had so much fun with him when I interviewed him a few years back because he's so frank. There's no...
Oh, yeah, there's no filter.
Right to the point. Yeah, there is no... And I like that, though. I mean,
sometimes knowing too much about something, I think it's very important to know a little bit about everything as well. That's one of the reasons that I took this job and I came to work to Ehlers, because I wanted to understand it's not as simple as making wine and just making good wine. It's about connecting with people. It's about... you know, about the business. I wanted to understand other side of the business. So yeah, I mean, I know a lot about science. I use it, but there's also a portion of intuition on how we do it, the things that we do it, and a lot of putting our personality on our wines. That's, we chose the style that we want, and hoping that consumers and critics are gonna like them. So we put a lot on the wines. It's not just a lot of thinking on the science and making out very correct. The chemistry of the wine has to be right. It also has to tell you something, to make you feel something. Because you know, wine also creates memories, creates experiences. So how to achieve that? It's not just the chemistry.
Right. I mean, that's part of your toolbox.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. This is the part where I ask the question that's my favorite one, and I believe I did ask you this last time, and I'm also going to mention for our listeners, we did interview you a few years back, which was so much fun, downstairs in the tasting room. But I'm going to ask you again and see if you remember. You do plenty of media, you do interviews, just recently saw a very nice piece on you. What's the one question that you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
Oh, I mean, I don't know. I think I've been asked a lot of multiple different questions. I mean, a lot of people don't ask me about what my regular day looks like. Nobody asks me, like, you know, they just think that harvest I'm very busy and the rest of the year I have nothing else to do. Basically, it's like, it's actually not true. Yeah, I mean, I don't get a lot of questions related to what is a normal day for me. Like, what would be a normal day for me, for example?
Let's go down that path. And for what it's worth, for our listeners, we are in your office. While we have this really cool brick wall behind you, next to us is your desk with your candy cane coffee cup. And it's an office like any other office where business is done. You don't need to go in graphic detail, but a typical day for you in December of a year.
Well, I that's my daily. So I come to work at 6 a.m. I meet with my cellar crew because they work very early hours, and that's That's a preference, and it's actually very helpful for me because I start at 6 a.m., I work with them for an hour or two, setting up the work in the cellar, whatever is happening. If we have to do rack-ins or we have to do top-ins, I always taste the barrels before they work with them. I go through with them through all the work orders and just be sure that they have the tools that they need. If they need anything, I can support them. So at least from 6 to 8 or 9, I'm always working with them. If I have to go to the vineyards or right now we are buying fruit from other growers. So sometimes after that, after being those 2 or 3 hours with them, I go to other sites. Or I just meet with the vineyard crew and check on what they are doing and how they are doing it. But after that, it's just coming to the office, tons of emails. It's very surprising how winemakers, we get pulled into answering questions for media, or I work with, you know, I'm very involved with the sales, obviously, and with distributors and with my sales team and what they need and these wines that they're promoting. And it's just like nonstop, a lot of work in the office. So I try my excuse is like, oh, I need to go to the cellar, guys. I'm going to be gone for an hour or two. And then I try to sneak out. I try to please someone save me. And I just go and spend another hour in the cellar with the guys. It's kind of like a mix of a lot of office hours and trying to catch up with the cellar sometimes. But harvest is just cellar. It's like, I'm not here for anybody else. But it's good. It's good because it gives me an understanding. I spend a lot of time with consumers, with our guests. When they come here, they can see me. And I get a lot of feedback, even from our distributors and the market when I work with people in the restaurants and or owners. And it gives me an understanding of what people like. And they like my wines. Or there's some things of my wines that is like they just hear the comments. And, you know, we did recently I did a relabeling of all of our wines. The packaging it looked completely different. So having that straight feedback from consumers, and they were very and people accepted them. It's part of I'm involved on every single aspect. And I really like it because I have a lot of freedom. And so it's been very rewarding. But that's a normal day for me. And then I go home normally around 4 or 5 p.m. And I have 2 boys, which are crazy. And they like basketball and they like to, you know, a lot of attention. But that's my day.
Yeah, that's a challenging balance. Mm-hmm. Most importantly, for our listeners, obviously you have a beautiful tasting room here and just a beautiful piece of property. If people would like to come visit, is it by reservation? Or can they just show up here? How does it work?
It has always been by reservation, even pre-pandemic, because we're small. It's a small tasting room, which is very cozy and homey, and that's what I think people love about it. But yeah, always reservation. We can accept people coming without reservation if we have the time, but we are a very small team, so we need that.
Just give a call.
Yeah,
and
give a call.
Most importantly for our listeners who'd like to find out more about you and about Ehlers Estate online, what is your website?
www.ehlersestate.com.
Great. Laura, it's just so fun to reconnect with you after so long. Thank you very much for being here today. I really appreciate your time.
It's good to see you. Thank you.
Learn more by visiting ehlersestate.com.
Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Pascoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.